This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. No news, just stories. You want to hear screaming and yelling and opinions? Tune in somewhere else. And we love to hit the culture. We love to see what's on TV. And it's the golden age of television right now. And our favorite show here on Our American Stories, that's right, Shark Tank. We love it because it's everything we love about America, that anything is possible through hard work, through innovation, through entrepreneurship, and just sheer fun. Because these people are just having fun. They're pursuing their dream. And really rich people who were pursuing their dream 20 years ago now have money. Now they want to give their money to other people who are pursuing their dreams. And what a great story each week. What a series of stories you see each week. Actually, a few different people pitch. And that's why we do the show. And this show is everything Adam Smith tried to accomplish writing Wealth of Nations, except it's a hell of a lot more fun to watch than read. Well, this week we meet Chelsea and Leanne, who need money for their business. And their business, well, it's called Lollyware.
Hi, I'm Chelsea.
And I'm Leanne. We're from New York City, and we're seeking $150,000 for 10% of our company, Lollyware. Lollyware is a new category of sustainable materials that you can eat. That's right.
That's funny. I just ate
my cup. We call this new category biodegradable. It's both biodegradable and edible. It's a new and exciting eating and drinking experience that offers fun flavor combinations for both beverages and desserts.
Imagine drinking your cold brew coffee in our Madagascar vanilla cup, or even a margarita in a citrus cup. Lollyware is a delicious alternative to disposable cups destined for the landfill.
Biodegradable. That's bio-regrettable. Mm. That is awful. Well, we like these girls, though, and the cups aren't just edible, they're environmentally friendly as well.
Our cups go from cup to soil in 60 days.
They're 100% vegan, gluten-free, and made with organic ingredients. But the cup is just the beginning. With Lollyware, we're creating a plastic-free revolution and giving people a reason to get excited about sustainability.
Sharks, we invite you to eat your cup and to create a biodegradable world with Lollyware.
Oh, they said it again. Well, the sharks begin to bite. And they start to wonder, what are these cups made of?
This cup is really delicious. I mean, I could see somebody eating your cup as a dessert.
What is it made of?
It's a vegetable gelatin, so it's an all-vegan version of gelatin.
It's 100%
gluten-free. It tastes a little bit like licorice.
Yahoo Food wrote about us, and they thought the cup was like an adult fruit roll-up. All our flavors and colors come from fruits and vegetables.
It's pretty impressive. So, as we always want to know, Alex, what are their sales looking like? And who are their consumers?
Who is your consumer so far?
So, we launched sales 3 months ago, and we have $110,000 in sales. And we're partnering with a $30 million event planning company in New York City called Save the Date, who has just signed a $1.3 million letter of intent to sell Lollyware to all of her events in New York City. We also are signed with one of the largest food distribution companies.
They just called you up and said, we love you. We heard about you. We're coming.
They saw us at a trade show. We were at Catersource in Las Vegas. In 1 day, we sold 3,500 cups.
Wow.
It's not bad, but you know, we always have that one question, Alex, and what's that?
What are your margins?
So it costs us 97 cents to make each cup right now, and we're selling it to food service for $1.50 per cup. And we're looking to take those costs down dramatically over the next year. We anticipate that it'll go down to 50 cents.
What? That is impressive. Impressive, ladies. So here, the girls tell the sharks how much money they've raised, and a feeding frenzy ensues between the sharks.
Currently, we're in the middle of a $1 million raise. We're 30% through. We have another $100,000 committed.
Chelsea, look, I love it. I think you need more money. I'm really not interested in putting up the $150,000 for 10%. You have an outstanding amount of $600,000. I want to participate. I mean, I'd be interested for getting more equity.
Sure.
If we put up the entire 600.
Yeah.
But I don't want to put it up on my own. I mean, I'm happy to go in with anybody else if
they
want me.
We would love to close out the round with the sharks.
How much is left in the round? And
600.
We could do 25%.
Chelsea, look.
Done.
Now, we've been doing this a long time. Has that ever happened before?
Not like that.
Not like that.
No.
You always see Cuban jumping in and taking it over.
Oh,
and
I know.
They're all so mad at him.
So Mark, Barbara, Robert, and Mr. Wonderful fight it out over this deal.
I'll go in. I'll take 200 of
them. I did a great investment with Mark for
I'll take 200 of them.
I don't think we need more than two people.
No, we're fine.
Pure equity.
No, before you go, can I say something?
Well, we'd love to hear what Barbara has
to say. No, I would like to say something. I prefer Mark as a partner because he's got three times as much money as all the other little men here.
Ouch.
I've done very well with Mark, even though we sometimes fight on here.
Yes.
We have a real offer, $600,000 for 25%. Do we have a deal?
Ouch. Mark has much more money than all the little men here. You know, women can take liberties like that. Can you ever imagine a man taking liberties like that with a group of women on the stage?
She didn't note, though, that herself, she's among that group, too. She's got a lot less money than Mark.
Exactly. So, who do the girls go with?
We would love to accept Mark and Barbara as our team Hollywood.
Good job, guys.
Thank you so much.
Wow. And for Mr. Wonderful, it's just really remarkable. We were just commenting before the segment started. He just really almost never does any deals. And they always are about what? What are they?
Royalties.
Royalties. Where are the royalties? And if it's not a royalty business, he just like dumps on the business. Like there's no other way in the world to make money but through royalties. But what would this show be like? It would be like Seinfeld. What would Seinfeld be like without George? I've always asked this question. You could lose Kramer. You could even lose Seinfeld. But if you ever lost George, I mean, I guess you would lose what? You think half of the plots of every show? Isn't George the one who gets almost everyone in a mess every time? That's what I thought. Okay. So,
yes, Lee.
So these women are grateful to get a much better deal than they'd asked for. And again, that doesn't happen often here on Shark Tank. And here's how they close things out.
This is a really surreal moment for Leanne and I. We went in asking for $150,000 for 10%, and we're expecting to have to offer a lot more equity for that amount because we're a very new company. And the fact that we're walking out with our whole round finished by our top two sharks, it's really surreal. We couldn't be more excited.
We couldn't be more excited for you. That is what America is all about. Couple of young kids coming in there with a good idea and a billionaire and a lady who made a fortune in the real estate business throwing down with them. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. More after this. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we might as well call this our government blues segment, because we look at government spending. And nobody does a better job of this than Adam Andrzejewski, the founder of the watchdog group for all of us American taxpayers, called American Transparency. Their transparency portal, Open the Books, which you can find at openthebooks.com, has all federal government spending and most state spending online in one place for the first time ever. The best part? You just type in your zip code and see where all this spending in your local area is going. We've done that right here in Oxford, Mississippi. And let me tell you, there are some people in this town who would not want the people of this town to know where they get money and how they get it, because it's disgraceful. And we may actually start to do that, though I don't know how popular we'll be, Adam. But thanks so much for doing what you do, and thanks for joining us today.
Well, great. When I looked at my hometown, Lee, I found $1.5 million went to our local Lamborghini auto dealer, and $3.5 million went to our Rolex jeweler. So, yeah, it doesn't make you popular, but it's good work to do.
We got one of our richest restaurateurs getting something along the lines of $700,000 to build his fanciest new restaurant. It's ridiculous. And another one to build a really fancy salon, and she's got a ridiculous net worth.
Look, every single billboard I've come to realize that you see along the expressway, it's backstopped by federal money. It's incredible.
Well, you know, we wanted to talk today briefly about the amount of money the federal government is spending on public relation to promote itself. Talk about that, Adam.
Well, welcome to the second largest public relations firm in the world, and it's your United States government. So we issued a report, an oversight report. We do these things, as you know, Lee, on a quarterly basis. And so in December, we came out with a report on federal public relations expenditures since the year 2007. And incredibly, we found that $4.4 billion was spent by the feds convincing all of us to see it their way.
Nice work if you can get it, huh?
Well, it really is. It really is. We found all sorts of things. We divided the report into two segments. I'm sure we'll go through these segments today. The first segment was outside contractors, and the second segment in the report was the 3,100 public affairs officers that have full-time positions, and they're very well paid within the federal agencies.
3,100?
There's 3,100 of them, Lee, and they work in 139 federal agencies. So nearly every single federal agency has a PR man, a publicity man or woman, a propagandist that works within the agency. They're highly compensated. We found that the average salary is six figures, and they make 77% more than what you would make as a PR person in the private sector.
And you're not counting their sweet pension and benefits packages, are you?
Well, you're right. They also get bonuses. And what we found was, since 2007, over $10 million of bonuses flowed to the federal PR workers. In fact, one of the bonuses was $35,000 in 1 year.
That's nice. Hey, you know, wouldn't they want to promote that, too, with their great PR skills? I guess not, huh, Adam?
Well, it costs all of us, the taxpayers of this great country, $300 million a year to fund these 3,100 public affairs officers.
And I would love to know, Adam, and this is even more serious, what's this going to cost us when they retire?
Well, I don't think you can calculate that. I don't think there's an actuary in the world that has put a good value on a public pension plan and what the actual costs of that are. So it's just, here's what we can safely say. It's a never-ending stream of taxpayer dollars that are going to have to take care of these people.
Well, the other finding of your report that I think most folks would find surprising is the amount of money the federal government pays to private public relations companies to supplement, well, it seems, this poor, overburdened 1,300 PR people who already work for the government. Talk about
right.
that, Adam.
And that's the whole rub of what we found. And actually, I mean, we're pretty jaded. We're from Illinois, where the number one manufactured product, as you know, Lee, is corruption.
Yeah.
But when we found that 3,100 federal public affairs officers just wasn't enough, they went outside for an extra $2.5 billion worth of payments to outside firms, you know, we nearly fell off our chair.
Well, Adam, we appreciate this. We want to keep doing these hits with you. What you're doing is important. OpenTheBooks.com. It's, you can't beat it. Type in your zip code and figure out where the money's going. It's our money, folks. It's our money. And finally, we've got a simple application, a simple site where we can find it all out. Thanks, Adam, for all the great work you're doing.
Thank you very much, guys. Thanks for your interest in our work.
Oh,
really,
you bet.
It.
Keep it up. And we're back here with Our American Stories. And we love bringing you, really, an entrepreneur like this. Because this is a work of love. Adam was a real successful entrepreneur in his own right. Sold some businesses. And then said, you know, I want to give back. And so he's used his talents to try and figure out the mess that is all this spending. Because the folks in the government just pencil whip you. And you can't get underneath the underlying underbrush to figure out where the money's going. And I am telling you, I was horrified when I clicked that number. The number of people who are far farmers collecting money from us, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 a month, all over Lafayette County here in Mississippi, and probably all over this country. And I'm telling you, you put up a billboard and you put these people's pictures up there and let them know that they're taking our money for doing nothing. I am telling you, you would watch that activity stop in a heartbeat. You don't have to criminalize it. They're not breaking the law. But it's shocking, Alex.
I was just going to add, when you're talking about those farm subsidies, one of Adam's interesting reports is they found farm subsidies right in Washington, D.C., right in New York, in Chicago, and there are these addresses of lobbyists, lawyers, they run whatever businesses, and they happen to have farms out in Iowa getting subsidies, all these wealthy people in these big metropolitan.
How about that? How about that? Well, great work on this, Alex, and thanks for bringing Adam to our attention. And keep it coming. We have a little beef with Hengler. Hengler did a rant the other day, and it was good. I mean, we liked it. It was on traffic and the things that really bugged him, and he's got some deep theories, but we think he left a few things out. And well, one of them is what we call slow blinkers, the people who either hit the blinker too late or the people who hit the blinker too early, but particularly the people who do it too early and just keep driving down the road with their blinker on. Really annoying, not included in your rent. By the way, just one thing. And then the other is people who are cruising down the street in the fast lane and going too slow. And we just wanted to add those two. And
yeah,
I know,
but that's not part of the ad. The people that are in the left-hand lane, that's not part of a rant. The rant is something that normally people don't think about. You walk up to anybody in the street and you say, what's a problem you have with traffic? They're going to say, oh, I don't like the person in the left-hand lane. They should go, you know, they should go to prison for going slow. Oh, it was so original. You got to have something original if you're going to have a rant.
You're like the hipster ranter.
You are.
Yeah, it's so, got to be original. Otherwise you're going to have everybody going, yeah, I feel the same way. You got to have people go, oh, I never thought of that. That's a rant.
Oh, I got it. So it has to be originality. So you're the rant police, basically?
Yes, and let me fix what you first said. To have a rant, you have to explain why. The why. Why is it that you don't like the people with the blinker setting it the last second? The reason is because when you're ready to pull it into traffic, you're waiting for that person to go by you so then you can pull out. But if he waits until the last second to put the blinker on and then pulls in right before you, it's like, dude, I could have pulled out like 7 seconds ago instead of waiting for you. I could be home faster. That's why.
So you're connecting their ridiculousness to your personal life.
Yeah, and everybody else's too.
I'm trying to understand the theory of your rants here. Just checking. What about the high beam people? That's not a rant either, people who put on their high beams?
I really don't think that's much of a problem. I think that's pretty well understood, so that should be chucked. It's not part of the rant. People, okay. Nobody drives down all the time with the beams on. I just don't see that.
You
as
don't
a
see
problem.
That happening?
No.
Oh, so far away, beams are coming. They're still coming. The guy keeps his beam on. He's trying to protect us, and meanwhile, he's trying to protect himself, and he's blinding me. I'm the one who's going to drive into a tree.
I'm not saying it doesn't happen.
It's just not a rant.
But to be part of a rant is it has to be a common occurrence.
Gotcha.
Happened Understood. To me last night.
Yeah, there it is.
You know what? Maybe I just haven't been in Mississippi that long.
You haven't been. Yeah, you haven't. L.A. I don't know what they do in L.A. And by the way, you were never driving at night in L.A. Did you ever drive at night in L.A.?
Before I got married.
Before you got married. Because he goes to bed at like 8:30 like the rest of us do. So, I mean, we don't even see the darkness anymore. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And we talk about important stuff like this. And Adam, by the way, has had his work, Andrzejewski, has had his work called out by one of our favorite senators. And it's Tom Coburn, who's no longer a senator, but I think did more for transparency and more for government accountability than almost anybody who had ever served in the U.S. Senate. So when we can, and if you would, post for us excesses that you find from AdamsOpenTheBooks.com zip code finder. Go in there, dig it out, leave a message with us at OurAmericanNetwork.org, and we will play your messages. We want to know, and name names, folks. We got to name names. Let's shame them. Let's get them out of the shadows, so to speak, and let's expose them. Again, this is Lee Habib. This is Our American Story. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And now it's time for our weekly Marriage on the Mind segment, with whom we like to call our marriage ambassador, our marriage coach, Deb Olniak, the executive director of Great Marriages for Sheboygan County in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, a group whose innovative couple-to-couple mentoring program has an 87% success rate in saving struggling marriages compared to 28% with traditional counselors. And what we're going to be doing here on Our American Stories is we're not going to bring you like PhD experts with opinions. We want to find practitioners and experts in their field who are making a difference on the ground. And Deb and her group are doing just that. Every week, Deb will join us for storytelling about marriage and take calls about marriage. If you have any questions about your marriage, Need advice for a friend going through marriage trouble or have a nugget of wisdom on the subject? 877-655-6755 is our number. And this week, Deb brings us an interview with storyteller Leslie Leyland Fields, an author of 10 books about her very own marriage story.
I grew up in New Hampshire, and I went to college in Ohio, and I met this wild and crazy Alaskan fisherman there in college. And we fell in love, and we actually got married while we were still in school. And then after we graduated, we went back to Alaska. And as I said, he's a fisherman. He's a commercial fisherman. So marrying my husband meant that I also married fishing. You know, I married fish. I married salmon. And I married Alaska, the whole state of Alaska, because he's born and bred in Alaska. And it just... he just would never want to leave. And so, we did, we moved to Alaska, and I have been married now and have lived in Alaska for 38 years, which I can hardly believe.
I can't believe it either. You look too young to be married 38 years.
I feel the same way.
Yeah. Well, and it's lovely that you've been up there. I mean, we all can romanticize Alaska, but Alaska isn't always the most friendly environment. I've got to believe that's got to be tough on a marriage sometimes.
You know, we have been through just some, through a lot of things. Because of the environment, because of the culture, and the culture, you have to understand, the culture of commercial fishing is, and you have to understand the place. We live on an island, off of an island, so it's very remote. It's Bush, Alaska. And we spent several years out there in the wintertime building our own house and with you know, just basically our backs and our arms. And we lived for 2 winters, just the two of us, on an island, literally 10 miles away from any other human being and with no contact with the outside world. So it's, you know, we've been through a lot of trials and building a house together and living in remote Bush, Alaska. And then commercial fishing seasons have really been a challenge for our marriage in a lot of ways. You know, we start off with this idea that we were going to, you know, work together and share all of our work. And so I went out in the fishing boats and the skiffs with my husband, and we worked side by side. And, you know, that lasted about one season because we discovered, here's what happened. And I think this might sound familiar to people with any sort of agricultural background, farming background. You know, once we stepped in the skiff, we were no longer husband and wife. We were now skipper and crew. So there was a hierarchy. And that's how, you know, sort of maritime culture, it's very hierarchical, right? There's one boss and everyone else is a deckhand or a crew hand and just follows orders. And there's no questioning of decision making. It's just simply you do it and you do it now, just instant obedience. And that was a real stressor in our marriage. And that really... that's kind of been the pattern that in that culture and in that environment, we sort of reverted to this, you know, boss and crew sort of relationship. And a few years into this, you know, I was really feeling the pain and knowing this is not, you know, we can't sustain the marriage with this kind of relationship. So the challenge has been in that culture and in our marriage for me to find a way to be heard, and for him to find a way to listen.
Do you feel that it took multiple years and multiple seasons, I mean, in this harsh environment, to be able to have that result?
Oh, it's, Deb, it's, you know, I'm 38 years into it, and we're still working on it, you know. you know, you never reach a place, okay, done, moving on to the next thing.
Tell us about the time where you're almost ready to walk away.
Yeah, well, in fact, I did. And what that meant for me, living on a remote island with no transportation, no access, no ability to escape, really. That island at low tide was attached to another island. And so I reached a point where I just couldn't, I couldn't go on. And I literally packed up a backpack of food. I grabbed a gun because there's lots of bears around, and I walked off the island down to a cabin, a shack, down 5 miles away down the beach. The only way I could get there was to walk, and I stayed there for 2 or 3 days just really wrestling with God and wrestling with what do I do next and how can we fix, how can this marriage be fixed? And Deb, I was sure that there was no way to fix this. I was sure that this was the end, and I was exhausted and ready to give up on the marriage. But you know, I eventually had to return. I couldn't stay there forever. I had to return, and when I came back, I found my husband so brokenhearted and so distressed and so grieving my absence and my loss that we were able to come back together and say, okay, all right, we're not done. Let's pick up. Let's start again, and let's try to hear each other, and let's see what we can change and what we can do to make this marriage work.
Yeah. Do you think it was communication that was the biggest point of need?
I think it was. It's, you know, everything is... That feels a little bit too simple to say that. I think there's a whole set of expectations that, you know, two people come to a marriage and they each have a set of expectations about what that will mean. And, you know, for my husband, he had a very traditional view that was part of what he had grown up with, where the husband was the head of the home, the head of the family, and made all the decisions, and the wife simply... just agreed and obeyed and follow along behind. You know, that was the old model that you know, held for generations and for centuries. And I think now we recognize that's not a good model. It doesn't work for either side. And my husband really did want a partner, and he really did respect me, but he just didn't, you know, we had to figure out a way to get rid of the hierarchy and let's just sit down together and figure this out together. Let me, as the wife, let me help take some of that burden of that responsibility that you feel, you know, being the one making all the decisions. Let's do this together. And you know, and that's what's happened over the years. It's become such a mutuality that it's really gorgeous. And I find myself, even though I'm very independent, but I find myself, whenever I'm making any decision at all, I go to my husband, not because I have to, because I want to. I want to hear what he thinks. I want his opinion. I want him to help me decide what to do. And he does the same thing. And in the old days, never. He would just, you know, make a decision. Okay, we're going to do this. We're going to do that. And he has come to the place where he so values my thinking and my opinion that he doesn't make a single decision without me either.
This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And when we return, more with Deb Wolniak after this. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And by the way, you're listening to The Doors and Jim Morrison. And every time I think about Jim Morrison, Jesse, I always think of Val Kilmer's crazy great performance. I don't think he's ever done anything since, frankly, that holds a candle to it. But it may be one of the great pieces of acting you could ever see. And you just heard a great story, Deb interviewing a woman who, well, was at wit's end, thought the marriage was over. You heard her words. There's no way to fix it, she said. And she was exhausted and ready to give up. And there were struggles internally, I think, over power and over who is in charge. And with us is Deb Wolniak, who is our American Stories marriage coach. And Deb, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. This is an exciting topic. Some people are going to be going, oh, my gosh.
It is. And I have always thought this is a big one. I mean, we always say the word communication, but you can communicate all day long. But if one person wants to be in control and the other one wants to be in control, what do you do about that, Deb?
Yeah. Yeah, you got two people trying to drive the ship. And what's interesting is men and women are driving toward two different things. Basically, it comes down to a very key thing that we can find in Dr. Emerson Eggerich's book, Love and Respect, which is interesting because what she desires the most is love. And what he desires the most is respect. And that's one of the key books that we tell people if they're struggling with power struggles in their marriage, check that book out. It can start answering some of those questions.
Give us the name of that book again, Deb, and tell us a little bit more about it. What did you learn from that book? But give the title real slow to folks.
Absolutely. It's called Love and Respect. It's by Dr. Emerson Eggerich. Actually, Eggerich's, sorry. And he does a very good analysis along with his wife. They came out with this book in 2004, and they did a great job on talking about some of the different cycles of conflict, resolving those conflicts, some of those things in that energize the cycle of conflict and ways to start to diffuse it. But the core piece is to look at the goal of how the other person is wired. So many times women just want to say, give me the wheel, let's run. And they forget about the fact to respect their husbands, even in the conversation. Just even listen a little more can show respect. And from the man's point of view, he's like, listen, this is all I'm looking for. Just let's deal with this. But she's just looking for that moment of just some love. You know, hey, I get all the logistics, but can you just show me some love here? Show that you hear me as well. And when they start singing the same song, even though they're aiming at love and respect, it actually sings a chord. It actually gets the relationship to start working together a little more because you're looking out for the other person's interest in that area. That can be a great fuel to help make sure that relationship is functional and moving in the right direction. And if there's lacking in that area, you're going to feel it. If one side is pulling or the other side is pulling too hard and it's all about me, which that's not how a relationship is going to work, it's going to fall, the wheels are going to come off the car. So if you just look at those two words, love and respect, you're going to start seeing some progress.
You're on to something. This is Lee Habib. We're talking to Deb Wolniak, and Deb is our marriage coach here in Our American Stories. She's also the executive director of Great Marriages for Sheboygan County in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. And by the way, folks, and it's such an important statistic, a group whose innovative couple-to-couple mentoring program has an 87% success rate in saving struggling marriages compared to just 28% with traditional counselors. And Deb, you know, as we get to the struggle sometimes between love and respect and sometimes between who's running this house. You know, sometimes I always think of the old Honeymooners episode where Ralph Kramden goes in and goes, I'm king of this household, and he wants to lay down the law because he's sick and tired of his woman making decisions, and damn it, she's the woman, he's the man, and this is how it's going to be. And a lot of this, I think, has to do with expectations. Talk about the expectations and also what you know, the families you came from and how power was divided. Talk about expectations. And do couples really talk this through as they're in love and about to get married? And is that part of the problem, that they never even have these discussions as they're courting one another?
Well, you're hitting on a bunch of things here. So the first one is a generational piece. You know, we can look at our grandparents and even some of us who are older, our parents, and look at that classic traditional style, the leave it to beaver type family. The man is the breadwinner, the woman is at home managing her household, dinner's ready at 5, the family sits down. We just don't have that kind of culture today. Now, not everybody's in that mode. There are some that still maintain those traditional values, and they benefit greatly from that. To have a dinner together is almost a luxury. And sometimes when we get to our Thanksgiving dinners, we go, wow, this is how it feels to cook in the kitchen and have a nice dinner.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, as we look to today's family, it is interesting as people approach marriage, and let's face it, a lot of us are living together and trying out marriage before we're actually getting into it. That's a separate issue and can cause some further challenges, which there are statistics for. We can do that on a different show. But let's just talk about those that say, hey, I'm ready to go to the altar, make the commitment with you. Let's go do this, plan this wedding, and get it done. Now, everybody can get married, but the preparation that you make before you walk down the aisle is absolutely key. And I'm going to give you a statistic. If you go through a program called Prepare and Enrich, which is our core mentoring program here, you will increase your chance of staying together for life by 70%.
That's
scary. Can you
imagine
that?
That's scary good.
That's scary good. Like, you would want to look at the person down at the end of the aisle and go, I am committing to you, and I know why I'm committing to you, and I absolutely love you, despite your faults, despite our challenges, but we're aware of what those challenges are, and I'm ready to go after life with you as my teammate.
But, Deb, is it also scary bad in the sense that a lot of people might not want to go through that mentoring early because they don't want to know the truth? They just want to stay with the intoxication of love and not hear outsiders' opinions on maybe ways to preserve that marriage while you're in this midst of romance and just pure, sheer, unbridled optimism?
Oh, sure. And some of that's really exciting, isn't it? I mean, that's like euphoria. But we all know that that honeymoon stage is short-lived. If you have a honeymoon stage that can last, you know, that first 5 years, you're doing awesome. I'm going to tell you something. My own experience, I thought I was in the honeymoon stage. And when my husband and I got to about year 5 or 6, we looked back and we kind of went, oh, my gosh, you know what? Our honeymoon kind of ended at the honeymoon stage. When it
was
over,
right.
We had a tough time. It was tough.
And so, Deb, in the power struggles that we're talking about, How does this ultimately, if the husband had the expectation that he was going to be the king of the house, and by the way, I my dad and a couple of his older friends often look at me and say, I don't know how you guys do it. Our generation, I was the head of the house, and now, how do you guys do it? Who's the head? You know, how can you have two people running a house? My dad always said, how can you have two people running a house? Well, Dad, I mean, we're managing it at my household. I think we're co-leaders of the house, and my wife handles some responsibilities. I handle others, but we negotiate everything, and we try to have an equal distribution of responsibilities. That doesn't work for some people, though, right, Deb?
No, it doesn't. Now, you picked up on something really, really important. Communicating what the things of the household that need to be done, communicating what priorities are related to finances and who's the breadwinner or how are you both bringing home the check, et cetera. Those all have to be talked about. And some people say, oh, well, we already know how we're doing that because we've been together for whatever. But believe me, after, you know, you get married, things change. The pressure's on a little bit more. And when those crisis things happen, you have to have a game plan. Now, I'm going to tell you what's interesting about this topic is in today's age, we have more and more breadwinner moms. And I have a statistic for you. Of 40% of all households with children under the age of 18, including mothers who are either the sole or primary source of income for their family, according to new Pew Research Center analysts, of data from the U.S. Census Bureau, the share was just 11% in 1960. But breadwinner moms are made up of two very different groups. Of the 5.1 million breadwinner moms today, 37% are married mothers who have a higher income than their husbands. That's interesting. And 8.6 million, which is about 63%, are single moms. So as we've seen women increase in the workplace and really bringing home some of that financial, that paycheck to help better their families or where their stage is at, and just to survive, women are having more of an input into their relationships, their marriage, and some of those decisions that are made. How the couple handles it will be up to them. I do believe that couples are making those decisions together more often today. And one of the best ways that I've seen married couples handle some of those things is they both have a voice. Some of those pieces that people are experiencing on the pressure from either the man's side or the woman's side also depends on their family of origin and how conflict was handled. So if there's a situation that arises that causes that conflict, you kind of have to go back and go, okay, wait, time out. What are we feeling here? What are we discussing? What's the issue? It may be that one of them feels angst because normally problems are handled a certain way. And if that's the case, talk it out. Say, oh, I know why I feel like this. It's because my mom actually made the decision on this issue all the time at home. I'm not getting this in my family. So let's talk about that.
Yep, and this is great subject matter, Deb. And you know, each week here on Our American Stories, in the Marriage on the Mind segment, we delve into one topic. In the next couple of weeks, we'll start opening up the lines to you. We want to first let you get to know us here on Our American Stories, our marriage coach forever till death do us part, Deb Wolniak. Thanks so much for joining us.
Have a great night.
You too. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And that's what we do here. We tell stories. If you want a lot of arguments, political arguments, debates, hot talk, you got the wrong place. But if you want to hear great stories, moving stories about everything imaginable, from music to art, to love, to death, to health, to law, you got the right place. And you're going to love what we're about to talk about, because in the end, anytime we can tell a story about individuals overcoming obstacles, we love to do it. The power of the individual. Often we often talk about God as well. Not any sectarian God. We're not into that. But just the power of faith in people's lives is seminal. And we want to talk about the good part of that, not the parts that divide us. And for this hour, we're going to talk about a book called Seeing Home. And it's the Ed Lucas story, a blind broadcaster's story of overcoming life's greatest obstacles. And we're very fortunate that Ed is able to join us right now live. Thanks for being here, Ed.
Thank you, and Chris is with us also.
Oh, fantastic. Ed, you were a baseball nut growing up, as so many of us here in America are sports nuts, and we all have our different sports, but my goodness. And it infuriates some in academia and even our parents that we love sports more than so many other things. But good luck changing that, Ed. It was a love you shared with and was nurtured by your dad, a dad who took you to this game. Talk about this game your dad took you to.
Well, he took me to many games, but the game you're talking about is October the 3rd, 1951. Bobby Thompson hit the shot heard around the world off the Brooklyn Dodgers. He was a big, big Giant fan. We were not at the game. We watched it on a 12-inch TV. And I came home from school blowing bubble gum. And he said, "Stop it. The Giants are losing. I don't want to hear that." You know, and he was sitting there with his rosary beads in his hand and saying that, "Hey, my Giants have to win. They haven't won since the late 30s. And when Thompson hit the home run off of Ralph Branca into the left field seats, he went absolutely nuts. He yelled at the windows, went to pull the dishes out of the closet to prepare supper, and he dropped them. And I grabbed my baseball glove, and I said, "Dad, I'm going outside to play ball." And I ran outside to play ball, and we were in the projects, in the housing projects in Jersey City, the Lafayette Gardens, and I was a left-handed pitcher. I wore glasses because I had a little problem with my sight. I was a premature baby that caused sort of some eye problems, so I always felt better that I could see without the glasses, so I took them off and put them in my back pocket and threw a pitch, and a line drive came back and hit me between the eyes. And that was the last time I saw anything. But the love for the game I always had and still have to this day.
And despite the game taking away your sight, you still loved it. And this seems so odd for people to wrap their heads around, that we can love the things that sometimes hurt us. And that was an accident. And it didn't in any way change your view of the game, did it?
Not at all. And my parents, knowing the love that I had for the game, my mother, she read in the paper that Phil Rizzuto was going to be at the American Shops in Newark, brought me there, and she spoke to him on the side, and then he came over and said, "Hey, Ed, I understand you're a big baseball fan." We started talking, and my father said, "This is the scooter, Ed, Phil Rizzuto." And before I knew it, he gave me his home phone number and told me to keep in touch with him, and he said, "I guess you can't give me yours. Yours is unlisted." I said, "Not at all. I can give it to you." And from that time on to the day he died, we were best of friends in 56 years. And he called me right after I gave him my number and started taking me out and encouraging me all the time. And that was a great relationship. And then my mother wrote a letter to Leo DeRocha, who was then the manager of the New York Giants in 1951. And he gave me a day over at the Polo Grounds on June 14th, 1952. And it was a day I'll never forget. And that was the day that I said, "I want to go into baseball." I sat there just talking to the ball players and asking questions. And they answered me like, hey, I was interviewing them. So that was my dream. And Rizzuto kept on saying to me, "You have to get an education. You have to go further." No matter where I went, I went on to the New York Institute for the Blind, studied there for 4 years, then I went on to Seton Hall University and studied communications, and had a hard time getting into baseball, but here I am.
Amazing. Talk about another game, I think, as well, and that's, well, Jackie Robinson and his story. And just about a minute here, because we're going to come up against a break, Ed. And then when we come back, we'll dig even further and deeper into the book. But talk about Jackie Robinson as well. We know about Phil Rizzuto and his impact on your life. Talk about the great Jackie Robinson.
Wow, Jackie Robinson, that was in April of 1946. He played his first game in Roosevelt Stadium for the Montreal team, the Dodger Farm team. And my father said to me, "We must go to that game. It's a historical thing, Ed, something you'll never forget." And we went there, and Robinson hit a home run that day. And that was history, history in American history, not just baseball.
You bet.
And then Robinson went on to play for the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1947.
You bet. And we're going to get back with more of Ed and Chris Lucas. The book is Seeing Home, and it's the Ed Lucas story, a blind broadcaster's story of overcoming life's greatest obstacles. And we're also, down the road, you might enjoy this, Ed, we're going to be doing Echoing Green. We're going to be looking back at some books about sports and life. And I don't know if you had a chance to ever read that book, Ed, but it's a remarkable story about the relationship between Bobby Thompson and Ralph Branca, the guy who hit the home run, the guy who threw the pitch, the hero and the goat. And it is an amazing and beautiful American story. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And you can catch all of our work, all of our storytelling on our website, OurAmericanNetwork.org. And you can also mail in your stories, because we love to take the stories you tell us and tell them back to the American people. More after this message from our sponsors. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and there may have been no better call in the history of sports. I might put Secretariat's final legs of the race at Belmont in 1973. That was just an amazing call as well, and of course, the American win over the Russians in the Olympics in 1980. And those, I think, were perhaps the three bestest calls, but I think in the end, most sportcasters would probably pick that shot heard around the world call. This is Lee Habib again, and this is Our American Stories. The book and the story is Seeing Home, the Ed Lucas story, a blind broadcaster's story of overcoming life's greatest obstacles. You know, Ed, I wanted to just dig in before we move along with the story about this love of this game. And, you know, when you were 12 years old in the spring of 51, your mother's brother Eugene gave you a wool uniform jersey that he wore when he played semi-pro baseball in your New Jersey hometown. And, well, talk about the pride you felt as you put on that large, heavy, gray shirt with the number 4 stitched on the back of it and the words Jersey City Eagles on it.
Yes. That was my Uncle Gene, who I love very much, and he gave me a uniform shirt that I wore and wore every day during the summer, no matter how hot it was. It was a wool uniform in those days. And my mother, she used a scrub board every night and washed that uniform that I could wear it every day. That was my shirt for the summer. And I was very proud I would go out and play ball with that on. And I was grateful that my uncle gave me that. And he was a big, big baseball fan as well as a semi-pro ball player. So I was very proud to wear that.
You know, you have this life-altering day, as you had sort of alluded to in the earlier part of our interview. But can you take us back to that day when you were 12 years old? And paint the picture for our audience. And by the way, I think so many of us in our lives have this one day or two or three that literally change our lives. By the way, we also did an hour on Bear Bryant. And his players talked about how Coach instilled in them the idea that one play can change a game and one moment can change a life. So be steady and be careful. Talk about that one moment back when you were 12.
Sure. Well, after Bobby Thompson hit the home run, I went outside to play with my friends, all excited that the Giants have won. And it was in the housing project. We didn't play in a baseball field. We played in we called it a skating ring. It was a blacktop, and we painted bases. There was, I was a left-handed pitcher. And I threw a pitch, and a line drive came back and hit me between the eyes. And that was the last thing that I ever saw. I thought it was the end of the world. I figured, what can a blind person do? The only image I had of a blind person was someone standing on a corner with a tin cup and a cane begging. I used to see that when we went into New York, and my mother and father gave me coins and my sister coins to throw into their tin can and help the blind. And I said, I used to feel so sorry for them. That's what I had to do for the rest of their life. And when I lost my sight, there was the one thing I vowed I would never, never, never do, that I wanted to become somebody special, that I could at least have a regular job.
Now, when you find out this has happened, of course, you've got to deal with this, and you've got to work through it. When did you know for sure that you were not going to have your sight back? And what was it like dealing with the doctors, your friends, all the people you know?
Well, the doctors say I was in a hospital for a couple of weeks, and I was in up until Christmas Eve in 51. They tried to save my sight, but then hemorrhaging started, as well as detached retinas. And in those days, they didn't have the advancement that they have today for detached retinas, and they couldn't save the sight.
And by the way, this tells you a lot, Ed, about science. I mean, this is why innovation matters. You know, today this same thing happens, and Ed, would somebody have their sight today if it had
probably,
happened?
Probably, yes, probably. My wife had detached retinas, and they have something what they call buckles. They clip it together somehow, and the rest of the retina that's working, they'll be able to see. And so she has partial sight.
It's amazing. And I want to talk a little bit about Ed. In the book, you talk about two people that help you get your groove back. And my goodness, what an effort this has to be, especially as a young boy. And it was your dad and this pop artist, and we're going to play just a touch of a song and a musician that changed your life.
If your sweetheart sends a letter, of goodbye. It's no secret you'll feel better if you cry when waking from a bad dream. Don't you sometimes think it's real, but it's only false emotions that you feel.
You know, I'm listening to those lyrics, and I wasn't sure. Yes. You know, I've heard the song a million times, but I was trying while I was listening to imagine I'm 12 and thinking, what would this love song have to do with lifting a young boy's spirit? But it's no secret you'll feel better if you cry. And then he talks about recovering your dreams. And my goodness, that's exactly what you needed, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And I was never into music, didn't follow music at all, and after I lost my sight, I started listening to music. Johnny Ray was the big, big name that year, 1951-52. And, you know, my father, he read about Johnny Ray, and he told me, listen, you know, he had some hearing problems, and yet he went on to become a big star. He's a big music star today, selling records. And, you know, he didn't let his disability stop him from what he wanted to do. He said, so Ed, you know, you have dreams, you go on and you do what you want to do. And that was, you know, what my father always preached to me.
You know, it's interesting. He was deaf and he became one of the great singers. And so, and that's so difficult for folks to wrap their head around. And then you've got the great Stevie Wonder and the great Ray Charles and Jose Feliciano. As other inspirational models. And you know, just as a side note, I was watching John Meacham the other day, and this tells you about my life. I'm watching him on C-SPAN talking about George Bush, the father. And it wasn't about politics. It was about this man's life. And too often in this world, we put people in the boxes because of some political affiliation. We don't do that on this show. But he had something interesting to say. He said, John Meacham asked him, what was your greatest achievement? And my goodness, he had done a lot in his life. And you could tell that running the CIA was big to him because this was a way to protect all Americans. But here was the biggest. It was he who championed the Americans with Disability Act. And here's what he said. He said, I saw always the possibility in the afflicted. And they weren't afflicted. I learned more from them than they ever learned from me. And I wanted the sense of possibility to be with any parent and child who ever suffered some debility or disability that should not prevent them from living complete and beautiful and full lives. Talk about something like that and the importance of that possibility.
That's very important. That has helped people more today than when I was growing up. They didn't have the Disability Act, the ADA, the American Disability Act, but today that helps other people. Youngsters and, you know, elderly people, a lot of older people lose their sight, and therefore they're helped through this act, where before, you know, I was told you can't do things, you know, just sit back. And when I wanted to get into sports, and I was told you can't do it, go sell newspapers on a stand or something like that, I was told. And I fought my way with the help of my parents and Phil Rizzuto, who gave me the encouragement, other people that were there. So today, more disabled people are fortunate in order to get help.
Yep, help, support, the laws are with them. And I think in the end, the examples, the human examples are there everywhere, Ed. And I think that's a help. But you didn't have that as much then. Johnny Ray was one, that's clear, this deaf pop star. And when we come back, we're going to talk about your father. We're also going to bring Chris into this discussion as well. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we're talking with Ed and Chris Lucas, the book Seeing Home, a blind broadcaster's story of overcoming life's greatest obstacles.
When waking from a bad dream, don't you sometimes think it's but it's only false emotion. that you feel.
This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. We're born again. There's new grass on the field. I just love that line. It's not the put me in coach part. We're born again. There's new grass on the field. And we're talking to Ed and Chris Luke. We're talking to Ed and Chris Lucas. The book is Seeing Home, a blind broadcaster's story of overcoming life's greatest obstacles. We were talking before the break about Johnny Ray and the influence it had on this, at the time, young boy's life, who had just been injured and rendered blind. And a lover of baseball, my goodness, this becomes difficult when you can't see. And what's he going to do with the rest of his life? That was one inspiration. The other was his dad. Talk about the role of your dad in your life. And in the end, your recovery. And this had to be, in the end, at a spiritual recovery, too.
Well, my father, he would never let me give up. He always gave me positive thoughts about anything I did and told me, you can do this. And when I started school, went on to high school, went on to college, no matter what mark I got, he would say, you can do better. You can do better. He never said, oh, you know, you're blind. You did okay. He always said, you can do better. And he was always encouraging me. And also, you know, as far as faith, he was there praying and having us pray as a family and went to church and made sure that we were very positive in our thinking of religion and having faith that things can happen, that pray all the time. And that's what we did.
It's very powerful. You know, we were doing an hour on Jackie Robinson, and it turned out we had learned from his bride that the power of prayer is what sustained him and Branch Rickey through those two extraordinary difficult years in which Branch Rickey had told Jackie Robinson, you can play, and they're going to come at you hard. They're going to hate you. They're going to scream at you, and they're going to want a reaction. You can only play if you promise me you won't react. And my goodness, what a difficult thing to do. But that is the power of prayer in our lives and the power of focus and obedience. Because in the end, that's what prayer really is. It's we're listening to God for cues, but we're also, in the end, supplicating ourselves. And we're trying to obey his commands. And that's very played a big role in your life. I wanted to bring in Chris, if I could, powerfully good. Because we sure. Just learned about Ed. How we were doing your dad. Chris, what did you learn from your dad through all the Robinsons?
Wow, that's the better question.
And it turned out,
what didn't I learn? I mean, there's
we had learned from
so much. You know, how can I,
bride?
I think the best thing I learned, the greatest lesson I ever
the power
got from him is any time
sustained him.
I ever and feel like I can't do something,
Branch Rickey,
something, or I'm a little bit through in the dumps or a little low.
It was too extraordinary.
You know, now
very
parent myself, and I
difficult years in which
boy, this is a struggle. I just look at him and say, look at all
Ricky had told Jack
that he's gone through, and you know, not just one obstacle, but obstacle after obstacle throughout his entire life, and all these blockades that have been put in his way. That who am I to say that I can't get through it? If he can do it, certainly I can do it. And that's part of the reason why we wrote the book together, was because, you know, obviously the setting is baseball. And that's a lot of fun, and there's a lot of names that people recognize, but it goes beyond that. It's a message to everybody. It's saying, no matter what you want to do, you can do it. If he can do it, you can do it.
You bet. You know, Chris, your dad said something interesting, because I find this all the time. And my dad, who is a remarkable dad and did the same for me, always brought me into inner-city neighborhoods, and he always wanted me to learn, A, how to play basketball, and he figured that's where I was going to learn. But he also wanted me to learn what happens with boys who don't have dads, and to go in there with love and help those boys and be a guidance to that boy and talk him at least about life and love and fatherhood. It was something that was absent. And something remarkable was said, and he said, look, I'm a dad. I love you. There's nothing you can't do. But I'm not letting you use your blindness as a crutch. I'm not going to let you be a victim. It sounds to me like that's what was going on, wasn't it, Chris?
That's exactly what was happening. And, I think that's a universal lesson. You know, you should not let anything be a crutch. You should, you know, there should be nothing in your life that you can say, I can't get past. Through the use of family, friends, faith, whatever it takes to get you through that, there are resources out there. So, I've been blessed in my life. I know there are people that have been more blessed, less blessed, but I've been able to have this amazing father and have this wonderful journey with him.
I actually think it's the greatest blessing, and I think if you were to look at America right now, forget right, left, rich, poor, the great gap in America is the fatherhood gap. And boys who and girls who don't have fathers, my goodness, and you can look at all the data after that, guys, but that supposition of what happens to a world when we don't have fathers, and particularly loving fathers, you can have a father who could have done the opposite. You could have had a father who said, hey, give up. You could have had a father who said, you're never going to amount to anything. My goodness, there are a lot of people who have dads like that, don't they?
Sure. I mean, I see that, unfortunately, like you said, the inner city, Jersey City is an urban city, and I saw a lot of that, too. I did see people whose fathers had basically said to them, you know, you're worthless, forget it, you're never going to climb out of where you are now, just stick to what you have. And I would always try, and I know my dad did the same thing, too. You know, you were talking about President Bush, people were the same thing, saying to people, look, you're not stuck where you are. You can get ahead. You just have to believe in yourself and work towards it.
You bet. And by the way, this is a side note. One of my personal heroes, and we're going to be doing an hour on his life, when his day of birth comes, is Bobby Hurley. And Bobby's and for folks who don't know him, actually, this guy is such an important high school basketball coach that 60 Minutes did 30 minutes on him. Because he's not just a basketball coach. He's a surrogate father at St. Anthony's in Jersey City, New Jersey, the little high school that could. And inner city boys from all over the metropolitan area take one, two, and three trains for his discipline in the end. It's his discipline they come for. He doesn't treat them like victims. He doesn't ask about their sad lives. He inspires them to work and be the best versions of themselves. I don't know if you guys know Coach, but if you do, I'd love to hear a little bit about him as we then continue your stories.
I grew up with his son, Bobby, so we're about the same age, and you know, he and I would have discussions all the time because my father was notable and in the news, and so was his father, and the lesson that he said he took from his father, the greatest lesson he ever got, was that his dad had so many offers from colleges and the pros, and a lot of money was thrown his way that, you know, your family would be set for life. And yet he said it was so important to be where he was and making an impact. He said, if I can just change one life and put somebody in the right direction, that's worth any money that could be offered ever. So, you know, Bobby told me that was the greatest lesson he ever learned, that his brother Danny and Lennon. It's the same lesson I get from my dad. You know, money's not it's great, it helps, but it's more about how you influence people's lives and touch people's lives. All those people like Mr. Rizzuto and all the other folks that touched my father's life, it's making a difference in someone's life. Even when you don't realize it, that's the most important thing.
Yeah, and it gives your life meaning, and that's so true. Coach Hurley turned it all down. I think it stunned people watching the 60-minute pieces. Like, I had a friend who I was watching with. He goes, is he crazy? I go, no, are you crazy? Are you not watching the same show I'm watching? Probation officer by day? What's he trying to do? Save those boys who made some dumb mistakes. When I make a dumb mistake, my father's taking care of it. These boys out in the streets, dumb mistake, no dad. He's a surrogate dad for a whole lot of people. When we come back, guys, we're going to dig into the rest of this story in the next segment. And it's a beautiful story, and we recommend folks that you buy this book, Seeing Home, the Ed Lucas story, a blind broadcaster's story of overcoming life's greatest obstacles. And my goodness, there's a father-son story here and a father-son story here, because what one father learned from his father, he passed to his son. And again, this is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And you can catch all these stories, including our terrific 2 hours on Jackie Robinson and John Wooden, both of which I think taught about the art of love, the art of possibility, the art of mentoring, and being a father to boys, even if you're not their father. And my goodness, in this country now, our boys need our love, male love, more than ever before. When we come back, more with Ed and Chris Lucas. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. You're listening to the soundtrack from a really great movie, Field of Dreams. And it was so much more than a baseball movie. And this is so much more than a baseball story. The story of seeing home, the Ed Lucas story, a blind broadcaster's story of overcoming life's greatest obstacles, written by Ed and his son. Ed learned a lot from his dad. We just learned that Chris has learned more than he could have ever imagined. And what a lucky guy he is to have a dad. And a loving dad at that. Guys, I wanted to talk, possibly, Ed, your take on a couple of other influences in your life. Tell a story about a lesson that Sister Rose Magdalene taught you.
Yes, well, I was in school, and we stayed there from Sunday night to Friday afternoon. And one Friday afternoon, my father came to pick me up for the weekend. And as I came downstairs with my suitcase. He said to me, Ed, you have to put these galoshes on. It's snowing like crazy out, and we should have over a foot and a half by midnight. So he said, you stand up against the wall and put your foot out, and I'll get on my knees and push the galoshes one way, and you push the other way, and we'll get them on. So while we're doing that, Sister Rose Magdalene walks off the elevator. And she turns and she sees my father and she goes, Mr. Lucas, what are you doing? He says, oh, sister, I don't know if you had a chance to look outside to see how it's snowing and how much snow we have out there. So I'm having Ed put on his galoshes and this way, you know, we'll be able to go home. She said, oh, she said, afternoon, let me help you. And as he was on his knees pushing, she walked up to him, gave him a push in the chin, and pushed him back and said, he's on Friday. It's only blind. He's not handicapped. Knew my father, so let him put it on himself. He came to pick me up for the weekend. And as when he came downstairs with my says, you can case, leave. An hour and a half later, we left.
It's fantastic. And, you know, sometimes when we help people with good intentions, we actually can, I think the moral of that story is we can actually help the people we're trying to hurt, the people we're trying to help. Let's talk about your mom, Ed. What was she doing behind your and your dad's back during this whole time that would impact your life more than she could possibly have known?
Oh, yes. She was writing letters to everybody from ball players to politicians, everyone trying to help me and advance me. She was always there pushing me along and saying, you know, you can do it, you can do it. And she did that to the day she died.
You know, it's interesting. We did a segment when Yogi Berra died. We basically did a dramatic reading of George Will's great column. And he wrote about these Italians, these three Italian guys, DiMaggio, Yogi Berra, and Phil Rizzuto. At a time when Italian Americans were really struggling in America and they weren't actually treated quite the same as lots of other immigrants. And DiMaggio was like, he was just, it's so hard to understand who he is now. But think Michael Jordan of baseball. Think elite royalty of baseball. Talk about Joe DiMaggio in your life.
Joe DiMaggio, after I lost my sight and became friends with Rizzuto, I went to a Yankee game, and he said to me, I want you to meet a friend of mine. We went into a special room, and DiMaggio was there. And he introduced me to Joe, and I was thrilled to meet him. And he said to me, hey, tell me, what kind of pasta do you like? Automatically said, Chef Boyardee. He said, Chef Boyardee, he said, get this Irishman a bowl of pasta bazoo. He said, you have to eat better than that. I was ready to talk baseball, not Italian cuisine.
Well, let me tell you, he taught you how to eat properly, which is, you know, no disrespect to my Irish friends, but I don't race to Irish food. But boy, Pasha Vazul, once you're good in there, you're on your way to a whole new way of thinking about food. So you have access.
Absolutely.
You have access to all these famous players, and more importantly, their love for you has got to move you. But how do you decide to take the leap to becoming a broadcaster? And more importantly, Ed, how did you get there?
Well, after graduating high school, I started a club in high school called the Diamond Dusters at the New York Institute for the Blind. And I invited ball players up, and was very fortunate to have Wendy McDaniel, of course, Phil Rizzuto, Jackie Robinson, and many others to come up and visit. And with this club, we had people read baseball stories to us and talk about it. And I wanted to get into baseball by interviewing these ball players and going back to the day DeRosa had me interview the players and meet the players at the Polo Grounds. I enjoyed doing that, and I said, this is what I want to do. And I was accepted at Seton Hall University, and I went there for 4 years, and they had a radio station that I was on, WSOU, and I had a show called Around the Bases with Ed Lucas, and I was able to go to the Yankee games and interview some of the players and had them on tape on my show.
Ed, you brought, it's clear, a certain level of humaneness to the baseball world that broadcasters had not offered before. And again, your blindness actually becomes an asset in this respect. And from what I can see, almost every interview you ask the subject what adversities they faced. And because of your own adversities, folks felt comfortable opening up to you to connect on a deeper level. Let's listen to one such interview with Dave Righetti, and that's one of the great Yankee players, and then get your reaction to it.
First question I want to ask you is about adversity. People have disabilities, and they overcome them. You can see that I have a blind as a bat. There are others that have disabilities that you can't see. And any adversities in your life that you can speak of?
Well, I don't know if folks know, but you know, I have 16-year-old triplets, and they were all premature, born just under 3 pounds, all three of them, and all had a number of issues, including some slight brain damage in each case, where one daughter ended up with some epilepsy, and basically she had some trouble on her left side from her brain damage, and but still played high school volleyball. Managed to do it one-handed, which is pretty incredible. A tough kid.
Tough kid. And listen to Dave talk about his girl. And who would have even thought to ask him that question? But you did, Ed.
Yes, well, I was very close to Dave Righetti. He was a wonderful, wonderful friend and still is a wonderful friend to me. And he came up to me after he had the children and told me that they were disabled. He didn't talk to too many people about it. And he just said, I want to thank you for giving me the strength to be able to handle my children and look forward that they will be able to be successful because I watched you around the Yankee clubhouse for so many years. And I always felt great about that. And this one day I went up to him and I said, David, I know that you never talked to anyone about your children, and I would like to do an interview with you and put it on YouTube so people can see it if you're willing to talk about your children. He said to me, I'd be happy to talk to you, Ed, because I know that you would know to ask the right questions and not be stupid about it. And that's how that interview came about.
Yeah, not to be sensational about it. You weren't doing it for the gore. You weren't doing it for the headline. You were doing it for the love, and I think when things come from that space, Ed, it's always a really good space. You know, there's this really great French interviewer, and in the 1950s and 60s, a dear friend of mine told me the reason his show is so good is because essentially he started every interview with this question, what are you going through? He actually believed that everybody was going through something or somebody close to them was, which meant they were, if they had any kind of human heart. And everybody wanted to come on this guy's show to talk about what they were going through because they trusted him. And, of course, it turns out he had so much in his life he was going through, and he was always perfectly happy to share it with folks. And that gave people hope that they could get through what they were getting through. I want to talk to Chris, if I could. Chris, you know, you're learning something always from your dad, but I think in the end, your greatest takeaway from all this, and particularly writing the book with your dad, which had to be different than knowing him. Actually getting this on paper had to give you, in some respects, an even deeper appreciation for what you thought you might have already known.
It gave me a much deeper appreciation. You know, we went on a book tour all across the country, and question would come up, people would say, what was the process like? And my advice to people is, even if you're not writing a book, sit down with your parents or your grandparents, if they're still around, or your aunts or your uncles, and even if you've heard the stories 1,000 times before, share them again, because you learn so much every time you hear it, and you can pass that on to your children and your grandchildren. And there were some things, for instance, my grandparents, they both offered, each one of them, to have one of their eyes cut out to donate so that my father could see again. And it wasn't medically possible back then, but I had never heard that story before. And, you know, we all want to do things for our children, but that goes way beyond. And to hear something like that, you know, I'm glad we were able to get all that into the book and share all these wonderful stories and reach beyond baseball and just tell a story that will hopefully touch a lot of people.
Well, you know, that's what we do here in Our American Stories. I was always an admirer of my Jewish friends because the Jewish people know their story. I think that's why they're so intimidating to so many people. They know their story from Abraham. They teach it to their kids. Their kids know it. And look at what those folks accomplish in their lives because they know their story. And America needs to know its story. And Ed, Chris, thanks for sharing your stories with us. It moves us to be better people. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. Thank you, guys, both of you.
When will this be, Ed, you know?
We'll get you all that information, sir.
Thank you, Lee.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, guys.